You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The very famous photo from space of Earth rising over the moon has been called the most influential environmental photograph ever taken. Only about 540 astronauts have seen Earth from any vantage point in space. One of them, Ron Garan, found the experience so compelling that he embarked on an effort to urge people around the world to look at the problems facing us in a new way. And now he has written a book called The Orbital Perspective, Lessons in Seeing the Big Picture from a Journey of 71 Million Miles, published by Barrett Kohler. He also appears in a new documentary called Planetary to be released on April 22nd, Earth Day. And I'm very pleased the book and film bring Ron Garan to our show today. Hello.
Thank you for having me, Leonard.
What is the orbital perspective? Is it related to what's called the overview effect?
Well, it is. The overview effect is a term coined by Frank White, author Frank White, who basically chronicled the change in perspective that astronauts have described from seeing the planet from space. And if the overview effect is that change in perspective that you can have, the orbital perspective is what you do with it. It's the call to action from the overview effect.
How did your experience in space affect your perspective? Had you gone up with a very different attitude?
Well, I don't think it changed any of the philosophy or beliefs I had when I launched to space, but I think it really reaffirmed them. It really made it concrete, and it made it obvious some of the responsibilities to leave the planet better than we found it, the need to take care of the planet, the need to take care of each other, I think really gets reinforced when you can see the planet from that vantage point.
Have you spoken with other astronauts about this?
Yeah, I think there's a common thread. I won't speak for other astronauts, but I have had discussions with other astronauts that have similar experiences and similar revelations, if you will.
Do you know if any of the others have turned to a new line of work, as you have, on the basis of this experience?
Well, I'm sure there is. I don't know of specific examples, but I think it really is a very, very moving experience that can have a profound effect on your life.
How have you tried to make NASA's manned projects and the kind of experience you had more accessible to people, given that almost none of us will actually have that experience?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I did right before my six-month mission, which is basically half of 2011, is we launched something called Fragile Oasis. And Fragile Oasis was a quest to bring people along on the mission, not just as spectators, but as fellow crewmates. And we wanted to, you know, we didn't want to just say, hey, look, we have this beautiful planet. We all need to take care of it. But we wanted to have collaborative tools. We wanted to have ways that they could actually do that. And so that was the goal of Fragile Oasis.
Well, I've seen a lot of film footage taken from from your mission and other missions. And Earth always looks gorgeous. And the whole thing is kind of almost overwhelming. But in the end, it's still a bit of science fiction for me.
Yeah, well, I think it's a little bit of science fiction when you're experiencing it for real, too, because I know on some of my first spacewalks, part of my brain was looking at the back of the planet, being out in the vacuum of space and thinking, this is incredible, this is beautiful. But another part of my brain was saying, yeah, it's really beautiful, but it's not real. A part of me would not accept what I was seeing was actually real.
How close is it to what we saw in the movie Gravity?
Visually, I think it's really close. As a matter of fact, I think that's the closest I've seen to what it actually looks like. But it's more of it's more than just a visual experience. You know, you're also floating. You're detached from the planet. You're physically separated. There's a void of nothingness separating you from the planet. And so it's taking that into the context of your experience, I think it makes it much more richer.
Haven't most NASA scientists warned about the dangers that are being caused by climate change? But not all of them. What about climate change in relation to your experience? Was that something that you started thinking about?
Well, it's hard, when you're up there for 6 months, the changes that you're seeing are seasonal changes. But if we look at photographs over, many decades, and look at things, especially in the high northern or southern latitudes, you can start seeing some changes. So I think, part of the problem with...
You can see the ice melting or disappearing?
If you're looking at things over a long time frame, then you can start to see those type of effects. But I think, what is undeniable is that we're having severe weather patterns. And that there is climate change. Whether it's human-made or not is kind of the debate, right? Which I think is really the fact that we argue about that and we're reduced to sound bites and rhetoric, I think distract us from the real problem, which is how are we going to mitigate the effects of these severe weather patterns on some of these really vulnerable areas of the planet?
Planetary, the film that you're featured in, makes the point that every living being on Earth is interconnected and that modern life has led to a disconnect.
Yeah, I definitely think, one of the experiences that was really hard for me to describe, but one of the experiences of looking back at the Earth for the first time from space, in some way I can't explain, made me feel more interconnected with everybody on the planet.
Even though you were so far away.
Even though I was completely separated from the only home I've ever known, somehow I felt deeply interconnected with everybody and everything on it. And I think one of the reasons why that is because if we heard of a natural disaster, we heard of a man-made disaster, we would fly over these places and see them with our own eyes. And I think another aspect of that is just this sobering contradiction between the beauty of our planet on one hand and the unfortunate realities of life on our planet. And that's another thing that really becomes very concrete and obvious when you see it from space.
What needs to change in how people around the world see the problems we're facing, especially when different people have fundamentally different ways of seeing things in the first place?
Well, I think the biggest thing that needs to change is this mindset that they're those people's problems are our problems, but in the reality, they're one and the same. We are all connected, interconnected, like you said, and we are all riding through the universe together on this spaceship that we call Earth, and we're one human family. And what happens on one side of the globe affects what happens on the other side of the globe, and it's an awareness that we need to bring into our problem-solving process.
Could your experience be somewhat like that of someone who emigrates to a new country, having a new sense of what his homeland was like now that he separated from it?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think that's part of it. You know, one of the big things for me was when I came back to Earth and I slammed into the ground in the Russian capsule, and I looked out the window that was now pointed at the ground, and I remember, seeing a rock, a flower, and a blade of grass and thinking I'm home. But what was really interesting about that is I was in Kazakhstan. And so to me, at that moment, my home was not just New York, where I grew up, or Houston, where I live with my family, but it was Earth. And I think that's a really profound shift that can happen.
In the old days, the capsules would land in the water. But in that return on the Soyuz capsule, that does a hard landing on the ground. And you write, quote, "It was like going over Niagara Falls in a barrel that's on fire, followed by a high-speed crash."
Yeah, and that actually comes from Scott Kelly. A couple weeks before I returned to Earth on my last mission, Scott Kelly, who's on board the International Space Station right now for a one-year mission, he was kind of giving me some pointers of what it was going to be like because I had never, re-entered the atmosphere in a capsule before, and those words are from him.
Mm-hmm. And it was like what you experienced?
That was pretty accurate. That's the best way I could describe it as well.
Now, what needs to be done, getting back to the environment, to change how people around the world see the problems we're facing? What can a former astronaut like you bring to these issues that others can't?
I think the big thing is to look at these from a global point of view. It's not, pollution in one part of the globe affects the other part of the globe. So we have to look at our Earth as one single ecosystem.
Can you see the smoke from forest fires or volcanoes with the naked eye?
Oh, yes, easily. And, I have this one picture that I tweeted out on my last mission where there were fires in Africa, and I think these were fires for crop burning, basically. And the smoke from those fires filled the entire atmosphere up to the limits, what looked like the limits of space, over the whole southern part of the continent of Africa, and it was really visible from space.
My guest is Ron Garin. It says astronaut. Ron Garin, are you still an astronaut?
Well, I'm a retired astronaut, so I'm no longer an active astronaut with NASA.
The book, The Orbital Perspective, Lessons in Seeing the Big Picture from a Journey of 71 Million Miles, and has a foreword by Muhammad Yunus, the Nobel Peace Laureate, but he's really involved in economics. How does that connect to what you're doing?
Well, he's connected because he's involved in poverty alleviation, right? So I think and some of the philosophies that he professes and some of the philosophies that have lifted millions of people around the globe out of destitute poverty are some of the same principles. And there are really two sides of the same coin. He talks a lot about the worm's eye view, getting into the nitty-gritty details of what affects poverty. And when you zoom out to the orbital perspective, while keeping those worm's eye details in mind and in view, and you look at the big picture, not just from a geographic location, but from a long time frame, those two sides of the coin are what the orbital perspective is and what could have a really profound positive effect on the trajectory of our global society.
With the drought in California and other weather events like rising sea levels, climate change has been getting a little more attention than it was in the past. What other problems require an orbital perspective?
Oh, the list is endless. I mean, if you look at all of the problems facing our planet, whether it's poverty, it's hunger, it's conflict, terrorism, I think those are all symptoms of the underlying root cause, which is we do not recognize our interconnectedness. We don't realize that we are all one human family. And when we hear about a drought, maybe it's in Africa or somewhere, we think about those people over there. But it's not those people over there. It's us. It's us Earthlings.
And the suggestion in the film Planetary is that traditional people do recognize that connection to nature. In fact, in some cases, like the Hopi, they pray to keep everything in balance. But it's modern life that has led to that sense of disconnect in the rest of us.
Well, I think that's...
So is just technology and modern life the problem?
No, I don't think that's the problem at all. As a matter of fact, I think technology is going to help us solve some of the problems facing our planet. A lot of the problems facing our planet have technological solutions. Now, technology is not the band-aid for everything, but it is a tool that we can use to solve a lot of these problems. And so I think the misuse of technology, on the other hand, or the over-reliance on technology could be one of the problems.
You describe a project called Surveyor that came out of collaboration between the conservationist Dan Irwin and the NASA archaeologist Thomas Sever, is it? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is a great program. It's a great program for a lot of reasons. One is that it's taking space-based data, imagery, and all kinds of data to do things like mitigate crises, disaster response, and things like that. But what's really beautiful about it is that there are nodes all around the world now, and they're starting to self-replicate, where there's regional centers that take this data and basically filter it down to the users on the ground, whether it's a farmer in the field. And it's a two-way flow of information. So the imagery and the data comes from the satellites and the space-based resources to the farmer in the field. And if something happens, like maybe there's a massive mudslide or something, that same information gets fed back up through the chain. And maybe they can task a satellite or task the International Space Station to provide some imagery. And it's an incredible success story of the power of collaborative action.
My guest is Colonel Ron Garin, a U.S. Air Force retired, decorated fighter pilot, astronaut, aquanaut, an entrepreneur, and now author of The Orbital Perspective, Lessons in Seeing the Big Picture from a Journey of 71 Million Miles. It's published by Barrett Kohler. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Ron Garin, G-A-R-A-N. He has written a book called The Orbital Perspective, Lessons in Seeing the Big Picture from a Journey of 71 Million Miles. It's published by Barrett Kohler. Can you tell us a bit more about your specific experiences in space? What missions did you fly on?
I flew for the first time in 2008 on Space Shuttle Discovery. It was a two-week construction mission to the International Space Station, and we brought up the Japanese laboratory and installed it on the space station. And then in 2011, I launched on a Russian Soyuz spacecraft for a six-month research mission on board the space station.
Is 6 months a long time to be in space? Or is that the average stay at the ISS?
That's the average stay now, although, like I said, Scott Kelly is going to be up there for a year. So that's, you know, we're trying to push the boundaries, push the limits of what the human body can do. It's not the first time. The Russians have flown more than one-year missions before, but we don't have a lot of data points on that length.
On the space station, you're only 220 miles above the Earth's surface. That's pretty close.
It is pretty close. It's close enough to that you can see details in some cases. You can see the effects of human impact on our world pretty clearly from that altitude.
On the other hand, you can also see the vacuum of space at near absolute zero.
Right. I mean, if you're looking at the Earth on the daytime side of the orbit, you're looking at this planet hanging in the blackness of space. If you get onto the nighttime part of the orbit and you let your eyes adjust, you see the planet against the backdrop of infinity, above the universe of the Milky Way, and it's really incredible.
Looking at the pictures of Earth in that film, I was surprised that it couldn't always make out the contours of continents. It was more like a lot of clouds and then perhaps the sense of a mountain or something else. Is it possible to see Earth the way we see it on a globe?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's going to be cloud cover for sure. But, you know, especially when you're looking at it over the context of months, you know, you really get to know the planet. You really get to know the geography of the planet and know where you are at any one time over it.
A long stay in space has a physical effect, but do longer stays also have a psychological effect?
Well, I think they could. I think we do a great deal of, you know, put a great deal of effort into mitigating that. Having contact with family is a very important thing. You know, there's movies that the crews can watch, but nothing beats looking out the window. And I think that's a really, really good tool to have to keep people going down the road.
But you have to agree on what movies you want to watch.
Not necessarily, because you can watch it. If you don't agree, then you can all go off and watch your own movie on your own laptop. So.
And what happened when you were with the Russians? Did you all want to watch the same movies?
At times, and normally we're trying to get together periodically to watch movies, and we would kind of alternate between a Western film and a Russian film, and basically share each other's culture, and that was a really rewarding thing.
U.S.-Russian relations are at their worst for many years. How have the political relations affected cooperation over the International Space Station?
Well, normally the International Space Station both figuratively and literally rises above of the fray, but every once in a while the politicians try and drag it back down, which I think is a huge mistake, because what the International Space Station represents is something that we agree on. Something that we agreed on and we decided to work on together. And I think that's a really powerful tool for stability in the world and for peace in the world. When you find those things that you agree on, work on those things, personal relationships develop, trust develops, and then we can use that for a platform to work on the things that we don't agree on.
Aren't Russian shuttles the only way for Americans to even go to the space station?
At the moment, the Russian Soyuz spacecraft is the only way to get to the space station. That's correct.
What about for other kinds of space missions? Do we rely on them as well, or are we still doing stuff in Cape Canaveral?
Well, I mean, from the point of view of launching humans into space, we're at the moment completely dependent on the Russians. And there is spacecraft under development right now, and hopefully that dependency will be short-lived.
April last year, Russian Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin said, quote, "After analyzing the sanctions against our space industry, I suggest the U.S. deliver its astronauts to the ISS with a trampoline."
Right, yeah. I checked out the physics of that, and it just doesn't work out. So I think, yeah, we're still dependent on them, even if we had a really big trampoline.
In the 6 months on the space station with the mostly Russian crew, did you get into political discussions?
No. I can only speak for myself and my time in space with the Russians. That never happened. And you really get this sense of camaraderie. You really get this sense that you're doing something that's more important than the bickering that occurs on the ground. And I think it's a real unifying force.
What do you think has made the space station program a success despite the declining relations between the two countries?
I think whenever nations join together, or any groups for that matter, join together to do something really challenging, really bold, really grand, I think that tends to rise above that stuff.
Although I've wondered about the bureaucratic obstacles, the ISS program involves legal, political, and financial agreements between 15 nations and 5 space agencies.
Yeah, it's a technological miracle and it's a political miracle that all of that has come out, and we have arguably the most complicated, complex structure ever built in space.
And it comes as a surprise also because many international agencies like the UN have a reputation for having enormous bureaucracies that get little done.
Well, I think in the case of the International Space Station, there was a lot of progress made early on before all that stuff caught up. And so when when the troops on the ground, if you will, were basically doing the things that had to be done to make sure that the program moved forward, a lot of progress occurred. But eventually, you know, the bureaucracy is going to catch up. But luckily, I think the processes that were put in place in those early days more importantly, the trust that developed in those early days allowed us to weather the storms, weather the eventual crisis that popped up along the way.
Former NASA Administrator Michael Griffin testified to Congress that, quote, the single overarching goal of human spaceflight is the human settlement of the solar system and eventually beyond. Would you agree that we should be focusing greater effort on the problems here on the ground?
Well, I think by doing that, we are focusing on the problems here on the ground. I think the more effort that we put in exploring the solar system, the more benefit we're going to have here on the planet in many, many different ways.
Griffin and others have been criticized for shifting funding from scientific research to manned spaceflight. How should scientific and manned programs be balanced for the greatest benefit?
Well, I think,
you know, especially since we're talking about tough economic times.
Right. So, that's a difficult question to answer, and I'm probably not qualified to give you a percentage of what should be spent on each thing. But I think what needs to be done is look at the whole problem as in its entirety and look at it. A lot of times we get very parochial, we get very stovetyped, and so you might have a camp of human spaceflight enthusiasts that are promoting that at the expense of science, and scientists that are promoting their scientific experiments at the expense of human exploration. And we need to basically have a more collaborative approach to making those type of really tough decisions.
Is an emphasis on the benefits to taxpayers the right way to even look at NASA funding?
Well, I think we always have to justify our spending of taxpayers' dollars, and I think don't do a very good job, we being the entire space community, don't do a very good job of communicating the benefits, especially the long-term benefits, whether it's technological spinoffs or direct tangible benefits from the research that's being conducted on board the International Space Station, and everything from new materials, new medicines, a better understanding of the human body, better understanding of our planet, of climate change, et cetera. The list goes on, and the benefits are enormous. And I'm not a paid spokesman, but I really feel that our investment in the space program is probably one of the best investments we can make in our future.
What were some of the things that you did up there that you don't have to do here, but that you brought back with you?
What's different
on
in
the
research?
ISS? Well, just like you eating and all sorts of other things. You have to make adjustments. Do you just see that as part of the experience up there, or?
Yeah, I think
you don't drink Tang anymore, do you?
it's a totally different existence, and after a while of being up there, it becomes the new reality, some things are different. Some things that we take for granted on the ground, we don't have up there, but we get used to it.
My guest is Ron Garin. His book, The Orbital Perspective, Lessons in Seeing the Big Picture from a Journey of 71 Million Miles. It's published by Barrett Kohler. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Neil Armstrong's walk on the moon in 1969 had one of the largest audiences in television history. What's your sense of how Americans see the space program today?
Well, I think that there is, certainly not as much excitement as there was during the moon landings. But I do a lot of speaking to children and to students, and they're all, just as enthusiastic as they ever were. And I think, I think that the space program does a tremendous job in inspiring the next generation, inspiring students to study things like math and science. And I think it's still in the forefront. But obviously, without a destination, like when we had the destination of the moon, I think sometimes the public might lose a little interest in that.
After the Trinity test of the atomic bomb in July 1945, J. Robert Oppenheimer and others thought that leaders around the world should witness an atomic test to get a perspective on the power of the bomb. Do you think there should or could be a program to give political and business leaders the orbital perspective other than John Glenn?
Without a doubt. I think the more people that have that experience that can see our planet from that perspective, from that vantage point, the world will be a much better place. And I'm hoping, I'm confident and optimistic that we are going to get to that point someday soon where flying in space is commonplace as flying on an airplane. And I think we're going to see a profound positive effect because of it.
You have founded the Mana Energy Foundation. What's its purpose?
So the purpose of the Mana Energy Foundation is to serve as a social enterprise incubator. And, you know, one of the things that we try and do is provide renewable energy solutions to help alleviate poverty. Our first spinoff, if you will, was something called Mana Energy Limited, which was involved in providing clean water. But again, if you take the orbital perspective, you know, we don't want to just come in and have Band-Aid fixes. We want to have long-term multi-decade programs that ensure that whatever good that we're trying to do is lasting and sustainable.
Were you doing anything in the general area of international humanitarian work before your first mission?
I was. I founded the Mana Energy Foundation before I flew my first time in space. So I didn't. That's why I say I didn't have a big shift in my philosophy, but I think it was reinforced.
You also founded the Fragile Oasis Project. What's its purpose?
So its purpose is to use this perspective we have of our planet from space to inspire people to make a difference and to make the world a better place. And again, we wanted to provide collaborative tools for people to do that.
The New York Times reported in 2010 on work that you were doing to bring safe drinking water to Rwandan schools and to generate clean carbon credits under the Clean Development Mechanism. Was that part of Mana Energy or Fragile Oasis?
It was Mana Energy Limited, and again, that demonstrates financial sustainability. So these are projects that do not rely on donors or do not rely on government grants. They're completely financially self-sufficient, and they're self-sufficient because in this particular case, they were generating carbon credits. So a liter of water that went through one of the systems that we put in was a liter of water that didn't need to be boiled, so it was carbon dioxide that didn't go into the atmosphere.
Some economists would argue that incentives to focus on immediate problems make it difficult to consider those in other countries or in the future. Is there something about the orbital perspective that can overcome short-sightedness or self-interested thinking?
Yeah, I mean, we need to get a shift away from thinking about the next quarterly report, the next election cycle. And that type of thinking, I think, is prevalent, especially here in our country. And I think that's really limiting the solutions to the problems that we face because we're thinking of just the short term, not the long term.
Haven't there been some problems with implementing a market for carbon credits?
Well, there's been a lot of problems. One is that the U.S. did not sign the Kyoto Protocol, and so the U.S. is not participating in that.
Do you think the United States is the biggest problem?
The biggest problem as far as a carbon dioxide?
And as far as resolving many of these problems, because presidents sometimes they send somebody off with a hopeful message, and then nothing ever happens, or Congress won't allow anything to happen.
I think there's enough blame to go around to many nations around the world.
Especially third world countries that feel that they're playing catch up.
Well, one of the things is we shouldn't require developing countries to get dirty before they get clean, right? And that's one of the problems with the way that the carbon market is structured is that to earn the carbon credits, you have to do that. And there is a big move away from that, and that's some of the programs that we've implemented are that's the argument that we use, that we shouldn't have to require nations to get dirty before they get clean.
Well, even if the United States is not the biggest problem, is it missing an opportunity to really lead?
Well, you know, I think that's a really good question. And in some cases, yes. But I think, you know, there's amazing things being done in this country. I think there's a lot that we have to be proud of. And I'm certainly proud of the things that are accomplished here in a lot of different respects. But as in every country on the planet, there's a lot more that we could be doing.
A listener wrote into our show page, Amy from Manhattan, asking whether it's possible to see any evidence of human development from space besides things like city lights at night.
Oh, yeah. There's many things that you can see. There's erosion. There's, slash and burn agriculture. There's deforestation. All of that is really clearly visible from space.
The Chinese are actively pursuing a manned program. How do you think Americans would respond if the Chinese landed somebody on the moon or were the first to go to Mars?
Well, I think that we wouldn't like that. and, you know, you bring up a really good point about international cooperation. There's a big debate going on right now whether the Chinese should be included in the International Space Station program or in any other exploration that we do as an international body. And I am of the belief that we should. Every country that can bring value to the equation we should have as in a partnership. Now, the Chinese are going to do great things in space, with or without us. If they do it with us, then we'll know why they're doing it. But we're not going to know why they're doing it unless we're doing it collaboratively with them.
Why have we excluded them? Because we're afraid they'll steal our secrets?
We have excluded them because we have big disagreements with the Chinese government, with a lot of the things they do.
They're a major trade partner.
That's right. But some of the same arguments that people make about restricting the Chinese in the space program are the same arguments for the Russians. And the point is, I think, that this is low-hanging fruit. This is something that we agree on. So let's bring the Chinese in. Let's start working with them. And then the same thing, I think, that happened with the Russians is going to happen with the Chinese. Personal relationships will develop, trust will develop, and then that's a platform that we can use to try and address these other things. But we tend to do the exact opposite. We use those things that we agree on as a stick, as a hammer, to force the things that we don't agree on, and that just doesn't work.
WMYC has a program that is broadcast through NPR called On the Media. And the program this week was largely devoted to the fact that the media have dropped the ball on climate change, that it just has not – we focus on all sorts of other things, the latest scandal, whatever. Do you think that the media should be doing more?
Well, I definitely do.
Are you frustrated?
I am frustrated. I'm frustrated because we keep focusing on the rhetoric and the sound bites as opposed to the real problems. And, you know, one of the things to think about is – you know, in which case is it a bigger error to be on the wrong side of? If climate change is human caused, and we treat it as such, and you know we hopefully mitigate some of the catastrophes that are down the road, that's one thing. If climate change is not caused by humans, but we still reduce the amount of pollution and the amount of poison that we put in our atmosphere, that's a good thing too. So you can't lose by taking a more conservative approach there.
Have you spoken to people in Congress about that?
I have not personally, no.
Well, maybe they should invite you.
Yeah.
But I'm glad we invited you. Thank you so much for coming on our show.
It's my pleasure.
Ron Garron, his book, The Orbital Perspective, Lessons in Seeing the Big Picture from a Journey of 71 Million Miles. It is published by Barrett Kohler. It's been a pleasure having you on our show.
Oh, thank you, Len. Thank you for the invitation.